This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, folks. So let's dive right into that week in review. The region said, let's go this week, from elections to shots, starting with the Boston mayoral race, where it was clear no time would be wasted in the path to change.
We're ready to be a Boston where all can afford to stay and to thrive.
It's going to take all of us to move this city forward.
Mayor-elect Michelle Wu in her victory speech there, followed by former candidate Anissa Asaibi-George as she conceded. Now, speaking of Michelle Wu, the mayor-elect placed the unfolding situation at Mass and Cass at the forefront of her agenda for the city. This as tents came down this week and some of those living in them had their day in court.
We cannot have a criminalization of these crises, opiates, mental health, and homelessness. It only destabilizes everyone in the community and perpetuates the inequities that got us here in the first place.
And the CDC and FDA say, hey, kids, roll up your sleeves and get Pfizer. Governor Baker says maybe we can let go of the masks in schools.
If a school building or a school district can get over that 80% vaccinated threshold, they can make their own call with respect to whether or not they want to have masks.
Don't worry, we will get to the masks, but let's start with elections. What races were you watching? Which themes brought you to the polls? What do you hope is next for your city or town and for Boston? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week, Jennifer Braceras, political analyst, lawyer, and director of the Independent Women's Law Center, and Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Jennifer, welcome back. Jennifer, do I have you? We'll see if we can get Jennifer. Marie, welcome back to you as well.
You as well.
Good to be with you.
Great. So I'm sure we'll get Jennifer in the next second or so. We were having a little trouble with her connection before the show started. Let me start with you, Marie, then, and ask you your reaction to Michelle Wu's victory this week. The city did give her a resounding let's go.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm one of the generation that's excited for the change. We have a woman for the first time, and we have a woman of color. But I'm also a Black woman who's watched for 50 years. And hope that we can move the agenda forward. And given the experience of Black folks in this city, after Mel King, that we lost an opportunity to move the needle for the Black community in Boston. So that to me was painful. I am excited. I am excited that Boston has finally elected a woman. And that is historical. I'm also excited that, you know, Michelle Wu, she ran a very good campaign. She ran a campaign that brought in a demographic that we often say does not vote. And that is the young, the more transient young people, the more middle class young people. She brought them into this race and they actually came out and they voted. And so that is a real shift from the working class, mostly white, demographic that has been the standard bearer for voters in the city of Boston.
So I think, Jennifer Braceras, we have you now.
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So I want to play a couple pieces of sound that pick up on the themes that Marie just struck. The first is Michael Curry, member of the National Board of the NAACP and head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, on the show earlier this week, reacting to Wu's win, given Boston's reputation for racism.
The joy was palpable in the room. The energy was palpable in the room. But more than that, I think just the affirmation that Michelle's win represents of the real appetite, the hunger that people have for leadership that brings a sense of urgency.
Okay, so clearly not Michael Curry, right? No. We all know Michael and that's not him, but it's okay. That was the other sound I was going to play with it. So let me just give context. That is State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz recalling what it was like when she heard the news and she had been an endorser of Wu. Now let's hear Michael Curry.
The city that still elected Councilor Ayanna Pressley, now Congresswoman Pressley, and she topped the ticket at large, that Michelle Wu topped the ticket at large, that white, Black, brown residents from across the city voted for a candidate of color even prior to this election.
So, Jennifer, I wanted to play that sound to kind of underscore the case that Marie was making. But now I want to turn to you and just say your reactions to the victory this week.
Well, I think Michael's right. It's important to point out that
Boston did elect a woman of color to Congress before this happened. This is a very different city than, you know, even 20 years ago, but certainly a very different city than it was 50 or 60 years ago. So I'm not surprised that they elected a woman of color, and certainly, you know, no matter how it turned out, we were going to have a woman of color as mayor, and so that wasn't really a surprise.
So, you know, one of the things that was also interesting to me, one of our producers, Chris Siderick, was pulling sound earlier this week, and he found some sound from election night national coverage. This is CNN's Don Lemon on the station's on their national coverage, seemingly surprised that Boston would elect a progressive.
City Councilor Michelle Wu, set to become the next mayor, first Asian American, first woman of color.
36 years old.
The moderate challenger conceded. It's interesting. She's a progressive.
Mm-hmm, big time.
In the city of Boston.
So, Marie, you know, we were steeped in a mayoral race with, you know, a whole group of candidates that were up and down the progressive continuum. And then here's somebody from outside the city surprised to hear that about Boston. Remind us why it's important that the country's watching right now and what this says about the city.
You know, well, it you know, the country's vision, and I know when you talk to folks from across the country, Boston is not necessarily seen as very progressive, particularly if you're a person of color. The visions or the pictures that remain in people's minds and hearts about Boston, particularly if you're a person of color, is that of the visions during busing. So it's really the 70s. And the experiences of folks there, the picture of Ted Landmark, having that, you know, being, you know, essentially stabbed with the American flag, the pictures of children. You know, I'm a child who was in school during busing, being attacked on yellow school buses. You know, those are the pictures that are in many people's minds, particularly if you're of my generation. And so, And then, you know, people who've come to school here, who've left, who did not have really positive experiences, particularly if you're a person of color. And so that is why it's surprising for people that a progressive woman and a woman of color would have been elected this past Tuesday.
So, Jennifer,
I have to say, I think that's kind of funny because outside the state, when I'm in D.C., for example, most people I know outside of this area consider Boston extremely liberal. They put it, you know, in the same category as San Francisco or New York, pretty much. And it's hilarious to me because this New England and Massachusetts in particular, Boston in particular, are known as being to the left of the rest of the country. Now, Michelle Wu is even farther left than Marty Walsh, for sure. But nobody I know is surprised that Boston's moving in that direction.
Yeah, one of the things this week seems to have underscored is the patchwork of perceptions about the city and the state across the country. Now, Maria, your first answer, you also talked about being a woman and watching this election. And with the two of you as our guests this week, two strong women, I want to pick up on that thread for just a second. Several women were elected and reelected as mayors across the state this week in Newton, Somerville, Salem, North Adams, just to name a few. And then some women incumbents were booted this week, too. Yvonne Spicer in Framingham, most notably, also Mayor Safatia Romeo Taken in Gloucester. I want to play a little sound from Lisa Kaczynski, Political Massachusetts playbook author, on our air Wednesday when I asked her about gender dynamics in elections, especially the incumbent women who were not reelected.
People that I've worked with at the Barbara Lee Family Foundation have noted time and time again the challenges that women face in government, particularly incumbents, you know, they having to go that extra step, not just to do the work, but also, you know, prove that they've done it, show that they've done it, go that extra mile sometimes over, you know, male leaders, male incumbents.
Marie, as a woman elected, a woman who's had that experience, I'm interested in your thoughts.
Well, it's always been a higher bar for women in this state to get elected. One, to be able to raise the funds in order to be able to run a vigorous campaign, to be taken seriously. I mean, we're in a city that's electing its mayor, a woman mayor, for the first time We're in a state that's never elected a woman as governor. You know, Jane Swift, who was appointed, as governor, it's always been more difficult to be able to pull the coalitions together and support all the key coalitions in support of women. I think that's beginning to change. Even if you look at the numbers, I don't know. I would guess that the number of women who are serving in the legislature have probably declined since I was in office. And I left office in 2010. So we've not had a significant increase in women. Where you've seen the shift perhaps is in the Senate, where you've always had. I mean, I remember when as a child, McGovern running Ways and Means. That was the biggest deal to me that we had a woman in that position. I don't know that in the state house right now, I don't know that we've ever had a woman in the House of Representatives run Ways and Means. Nor have we had a woman as speaker. So those are really tough bars that we still, in terms of how conservative in many instances Boston is, particularly as it relates to women. And I do want to say to Jennifer, it's about demographics and how we experience the city and the state. And so I would say that depending upon where you fall in that demographics, your experience is very different.
So, Jennifer, I want to bring one more topic in here before we move on, and it stays with women, and I'm just going to lead into it by a little bit of sound from Anissa Seibe-George speaking Tuesday night, conceding the election.
This race may technically be over, but the work is not done. Our work is not done. It's going to take every single one of us, and I promise you I'm never going to stop fighting for this city that I love. I am never going to stop fighting for the people that I love.
So now, by January, Anissa Seibe-George, Andrea Campbell, Kim Janey, all out of their roles in the city council, all out of public office, all strong women leaders in the city of Boston, what do you want to see from them next?
Well, let me just go back to sort of the earlier point about women, the difficulty of women getting elected generally. I think there's no question that it's hard for working mothers to get elected for a whole variety of reasons. It's hard for them to make the choice to run when they have families and young kids. But I do not believe for a second that this state in any way discriminates against female politicians. We have a very strong female senator in Elizabeth Warren. We have very strong female representatives in Congress. And I don't think, you know, that there's a gender issue at all. Am I happy to see a woman elected to the mayor, you know, to be mayor of Boston? Of course I am. But I don't think that her being a woman was in any way prohibitive. If anything, it may have helped her in this race.
So we did notice, by the way, in her acceptance speech that she said her two sons asked her if a boy was allowed to run for mayor. There's so much more here that we could talk about, but there are many other subjects I want to make sure we get to today, too. So still with us this week, former State Representative Marie St. Fleur and Jennifer Braceras, director of the Independent Women's Law Center, and you. The number is 1-800-423-8255. More action by the city at the area surrounding Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard this week as the city continued to remove tents and temporary shelters used by those who are unhoused there. And a court opened up in the South Bay Correctional Facility to real controversy. And now with Mayor-elect Michelle Wu vowing to put in a cabinet-level position, a lot of crisis, a lot of need, a lot of controversy about how to respond. Share your thoughts. Is the city doing the right thing? What do you think about the court being set up there? Do we have the services we need? And what does the rest of the region need to do? Again, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marie St. Fleur, I'm going to start with a sweeping question. What grade would you give the city today, right now, on how it is handling the complex humanitarian crisis at Mass Ave and Melnea Cass Boulevard?
It's been an ongoing problem. I would give the city a C. I think they're between a rock and a hard place, but I also think that they have not been aggressive enough consistently, both the Walsh administration and the Janey administration, and in terms of addressing this issue with intentionality and in terms of driving the resources there and making certain that we can avoid, we could have avoided getting to the place we are. I think lack of planning, lack of intentionality has gotten us to where we are. And I am concerned that we do not criminalize everyone that's sitting out there in Malnea Cass because they really have real issues. And a lot of them have to be handled through a public health perspective versus a criminal justice lens. And I do hope that we're not just moving them out of the way so that we could make it all more appealing for the general public.
So I'm going to play two pieces of sound here, Jennifer Preceras, picking up on Marie. The first is Mayor-elect Wu on prioritizing Madison Cass as she prepares to step into her office.
We need to ensure that we are leading with a public health lens. And so I support the emphasis on avoiding any sort of criminalization of people who are seeking treatment and in need of services, and moving quickly so that we are connecting residents with those resources.
So I was looking for another piece of sound, and then I'm realizing we already played it earlier, which was Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins talking about the challenge of not having another option. So I'm going to turn back to you on that, Jennifer Preceras. This concept of criminalization and other options. Wait, no, we do have the sound. Folks, I'm just being transparent with you. I was having a little trouble finding the sound. I do want to play it. This is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins on Monday.
I don't believe this is ideal, but this was the only thing that was put on the table, and we have reached a point where we have to do something because I am the one that gets the notifications of unattended death. It's not any of these other people. It's the Boston police that notify me every time somebody dies, and that's a problem.
So tensions there between what to do right now and the real concern about criminalization, Jennifer Preceras.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with District Attorney Rollins that there's no other option now. This has to be done. And I disagree with the framing of the issue as criminalization. When you're talking about providing treatment in a setting that may be run by the criminal justice system, that is not criminalization per se. People overuse that word. And to the extent that some of these people are actually interacting with the criminal justice system, being prosecuted for things, it's only because they have outstanding warrants and outstanding criminal history with law enforcement. So nobody is punishing them for being addicted or having mental health issues. That's simply not happening.
So, Marie, Deb Becker, WBUR's Deb Becker, has been reporting on this on an ongoing basis and was at the temporary court when it opened for business on Monday and described the outcome for one of the first individuals brought before the judge.
The Suffolk County District Attorney made a deal and said, we won't arraign this person on new possession charges if this person is allowed to go to treatment. But the person had outstanding cases in West Roxbury District Court. So Boston Municipal Court Judge Paul Tesler said that he would not agree with releasing this gentleman to treatment, and he had to go to the West Roxbury Court to deal with the open cases.
So I think I want to turn to you, Marie, to talk about the complexity of this situation as well. Homelessness, addiction, marginalization. We also know that there is crime happening in the area. How do we grapple with the full complexity of that?
But the underlying issue is the addiction. I mean, I think what we've done is we have criminalized this population. The underlying issue, which is why you have some of them before the court, is because their addiction has led them down a path, and you know, which has brought them before the criminal justice court. This is a public health crisis. There are basic sanitation issues that needs to be addressed down there. There's basic treatment, but there hasn't been any real mobilization of the resources. We are sitting in the city of Boston, where we're then less than a mile from where these folks are located, their major medical centers, all right, their addiction and treatment centers. And those entities have not been mobilized in a real substantial way to address this issue.
I'm going to pick
up. The reality, it is a homelessness issue, but where are we in identifying transitional housing at
part
the moment?
The problem is it's very difficult to force people to get treatment who don't want treatment. And anybody who has, for example, a mentally ill relative or a relative who suffered with addiction knows this to be true. It's one of the biggest problems, and this is the whole issue we see with conservatorship that is so difficult sometimes to get and then often difficult for an individual to get out of. The reality is that the vast majority of these folks are folks with medical problems. They are either addicted or they have severe mental health problems. They are not people simply who are economically, disadvantaged. They are not people who are simply, as you said, unhoused. They are people who are sick. And you're right, they do need medical treatment first and foremost. But they do not have a right to live there on the street. It is creating a public health crisis for the people who work and operate businesses and live in that area. And this is the only thing right now that can be done, and I'm glad to see the city finally doing it.
I'm going to pick up a call here, 1-800-423-8255. Kathy from Somerville, ready to add a voice here. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. As somebody who has been unhoused a number of times, in childhood and adulthood, and someone who has many family members and friends who struggle with addiction, I just think that the city needs to be doing a better job of looking upstream at the root causes of homelessness. I don't think that sending people to treatment will be that helpful because most likely those people aren't making the choice themselves. They're being forced to do it, and they're probably going to relapse and just end up on the street again. And I just think, I don't know, it just feels pretty wrong to, focus on.
So, Kathy, you're starting to sort of struggle for your words a little bit there, and what you've already said is really powerful. So if you don't mind, I'd like to pick up on it, and I want to thank you for calling and sharing your story. I think it's important. I'm going to pick up a couple of voices now, sound, to underscore some of what Kathy just said. The first is Lyndia Downey, who is the executive director of Pine Street Inn, which is the largest homeless services provider in New England. And she thinks we have some real long-term service provision issues.
We have got to keep working on these long-term systemic changes. How do we get long-term, really in-depth treatment for people that deals with everything that's been thrown at them? How do we, again, get more affordable and supportive housing? So I think we've got to work on the immediate and the systemic changes at the same time.
And in that immediate space, we heard Mayor-elect Wu this week talking about those barriers of getting the unhoused into shelter.
Even though we have shelter beds that are available, there are barriers to accessing shelter, and the types of settings that these shelters represent are not settings that everyone feels safe in, where there are many people in one large space all together and difficulty securing your belongings.
So, Marie, in covering this, in listening to this, in listening to the many, many voices, I consistently hear people of goodwill who are recognizing that we have long-term issues in terms of service capacity. And while we're falling short, we have a crisis. So how do we develop both the will and the resources to move the long term into the short term and get busy here?
So I think what I want to say, there is an emergency situation, but the question is who leads the solution here? And I want to suggest again, I think Lyndia touched on it, that there has to be ways for us to identify some supportive housing. They're not going to go to the shelters. Some supportive housing, if you house them first, bring the services around them, those models have been proven to be very successful. But we haven't been able to do that in the city of Austin. And the reality is the houses of correction have been the first and last place of resolution for these individuals. And what's happened is they go in, they come out, and as that young lady said, they're back on the street. So we need to do something differently. We need to be able to identify, the city and the state must be willing to identify the supportive housing, and encourage the folks to go there, place the services around them. And at the same time, I will agree with Jennifer, the laws have to be reviewed in order to figure out, in order to give family members more opportunity to be able to support these individuals in a more appropriate way, because there are legal constraints to what can be done.
All right. Sorry.
So that's the real challenge, is housing first, and the city and the state must work together to provide that. A jail cell is not necessarily that solution, even in an emergency.
I'm going to grab a couple calls here. We've got Nick in Quincy. Nick, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the Long Island treatment facility that's now not open because the bridge was taken down a few years ago. As a resident of Quincy, I'm really almost embarrassed that our political establishment in this town has not allowed them to get work done to rebuild that bridge, because, you know, the reasons given that it would affect traffic flow and things like that, it just doesn't really matter when you think about the scope of what's really going on in Boston. And I really feel like we should do our fair share to help.
Nick, thanks for bringing in a voice from Quincy, which has been a key player here. I appreciate it. Let's also grab Molly in Somerville. Molly, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to bring up that there's FEMA money to help with homelessness funding, FEMA Public Assistance Program Category B. And I talked to some state lawmakers, and it seems like nobody is taking up this federal money to help this crisis.
All right. So listen, Nick and Molly, thanks for those calls. I think actually we'll give callers the last word there. There's more that I want to get to. So Marie St. Fleur, Jennifer Braceras, listeners, stay with us. When we come back, vaccines for kids. On our way out today, we are going to talk about kids and vaccines, how it should change policies and public health around the state, whether you're ready. It's not ask the doctors. We do not have two medical professionals here to answer your doctor's questions, but we do want to know what you think. And the number is 1-800-423-8255 to join that conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer Braceras, kids 5 to 11 can be vaccinated now. Overall, do you think the parents in the Commonwealth are going to do it?
You know, I don't know. I don't have kids in that age group. My children are all over 16 and have all been vaccinated. I would certainly hope so. Were my kids younger, I would get them vaccinated. I think there, you know, there remains some hesitancy, even by people who are fully vaccinated themselves and who are pro-vaccine. There's some hesitancy about vaccinating, you know, their younger children, but I'm hoping that that won't hold them back, because it's important that everybody get vaccinated.
I'm going to play a little sound by Dr. Clovine Campbell, the medical director of the Pediatric Associates of Greater Salem and Beverly. They manage thousands of patients, and here's how she counsels parents who are worried about the newness of this vaccine.
Pediatricians and doctors and health care providers everywhere would not give a vaccine to themselves or their own children if they did not think it was safe. I would never give it to my own two children who I love if I did not think the vaccine was safe. And I gave it to my children the first chance I got.
So in listening to her, Marie St. Fleur, I'm thinking about all the messaging that went on early in the vaccine rollout to adults and how worried people were about vaccine safety. That feels like a really long time ago, but now you have kids, right? You have parents who may even have had the shots themselves, but it's their kids. It's a different stewardship. What is the public health messaging that we need in the Commonwealth right now?
I think it goes back to the safety issue. And I have to say, and being able to trust your medical professionals, because at the end of the day, that's who they need to speak with in order to get some assurances as to whether or not they allow their children to take this vaccine. I don't have children in that age bracket either. I'm just being grateful. All my children who are adults at this time have taken it. I always point out that, you know, I remember, you know, when, you know, all my kids had to take all these vaccines that were mandatory. In fact, I realized that half the time, you know, there was not that big discussion about what they were, how they were created. I mean, it was just what you had to do in order to get have your kid go to school. I do think that that people have to take the medical professionals, political pundits like ourselves and other folks have to just take a backseat, let the medical profession speak on this issue, messages for the families, and would encourage them based upon what they know about their children's health, their conversations with their medical provider. I would encourage them to go ahead and take it. It's for their child's safety, but it's also for the safety of the child who they're of their neighbor, right? And so I would encourage them to take it, given where we are and the amount of public scrutiny that this particular vaccine has undergone.
So, Jennifer, I want to pick up on one other thing on the then and now. So the governor announced yesterday that kids can receive vaccinations at more than 500 locations around the Commonwealth. And the plan over time is, pharmacies, pediatrician's office, there are even sort of kid-friendly places like museums that are preparing to open for vaccine clinics. And it got me thinking about the safe environment that a kid needs to get a shot versus an adult. I'm going to bring this more sound from Dr. Clovine Campbell, who's that medical director with Pediatric Associates of Greater Salem and Beverly. And I asked to remind us, you know, kids are scared of shots, right?
I will admit that it is challenging for that age group, which is 5 to 11 years old. They're not quite as mature and they have much more fear of vaccines. So I feel like giving it in a smaller setting is not a bad idea.
And so are we in a place now where we can just accommodate the way people need to encounter a vaccine in a way that we couldn't when the vaccines were just rolling out? And what will that mean for speed of distribution for uptake, do you think?
I mean, I think getting more shots in more arms faster is the most important thing. And look, you know, I had kids who were very afraid of getting shots in the doctor's office when they were little, who were very afraid of having blood tests when they needed to have them. The doctor's office itself can be a frightening place for some kids. So I think, you know, if offering it at schools as they are in our community or, as you mentioned, children's museums, I don't think it matters. I think many of those places are less intimidating than a doctor's office to a small child. But the bottom line is we just have to make it as easy for people to get to those locations as possible and provide the vaccine in places that are convenient to the public. That's the primary, should be the primary focus.
1-800-423-8255. We've got Ruben on the line in Dartmouth. Ruben, go ahead.
Hi. My daughter is 6 years old, and I fully intend on getting her vaccinated. But should her school reach 80% vaccination and lift the mask mandate, I'm going to try my best to keep her masked, only because it seems that in the past 2 years, she hasn't brought home a cold from school now that she's wearing that mask. And it'll be hard, but, you know, now if she has a cold now, it means she's got to stay home from school for a few days.
Thanks for that call, Ruben. And it does introduce this question of schools and masks. Really different approaches here. Marie St. Fleur, in the last debate that I got to help co-moderate on WCVB-TV in the Boston mayoral's race, both candidates said masks stay on this year in school. Governor Baker saying something different. If 80% of kids and staff in a school get vaccinated, that school can choose to apply to remove masks. How important is that flexibility as an incentive to people to get the vaccine? Ruben doesn't need it as an incentive. He was going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps for some communities, it will be a real incentive. I mean, 80% is what's being quoted, I guess, is that herd immunity that everyone's talking about. I think each parent will going to have to make their own decisions about whether or not, even with herd immunity, that they would want their kids to remove the mask. I say the most protection, the better. But if it's a way of encouraging the larger populace to take the vaccine, then I say go for it, and then each person make their own decisions. I mean, it allows some flexibility for parents.
Jennifer, your
take. I think
it's
extremely important because what I hear from people, adults who have chosen not to get vaccinated, is they say, well, if they're not going to let us take off the masks, what's the point? And I hear that time and time again. So I think incentivizing vaccinations by allowing people, communities that have reached that critical mass of vaccination to have more freedom is really important. I find it very frustrating the lack of flexibility that the school systems and politicians seem to offer. I mean, last year when we were talking about trying to get the schools reopen, and in the school district where I live, the superintendent said that the schools were going to, we were hybrid, that the schools were going to continue with what they were doing, irrespective of the facts on the ground, irrespective of changes on the ground, we were going to finish the school year the way we started the school year. And it was only because Governor Baker and the Department of Education intervened and said, no, you're going to bring these kids back to school at the end of April, that they caved on that. It seems that there's a complete lack of flexibility and ability to respond to changing circumstances that's just crazy, in my opinion.
So, Marie St. Fleur, to pick up on that, earlier in the week we had Dr. Sandro Galea on the air. He is the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, and he'd written a book about preparing for the next contagion. And one of the key points that he made was that there is a difference between caring for people's health and keeping a disease from spreading. And he did lament that we have not, as we've grown in our understanding of the coronavirus, how it spreads, our scientific responses, moved away a little more from disease spread prevention and towards understanding the building blocks of people's health, which includes their mental health, socio-emotional health, economic health. I wonder if we are having an effective enough conversation about health as we're talking about disease prevention.
I don't think that we have. I mean, I did not hear that segment, but I think we have been so focused sort of on an emergency response to suppress the spread of the disease that we have not really shifted to really what is the long-term action plan for mitigating that? Because it's here. It's like the flu. It's not going anywhere. And so how are we going to teach people to manage their health better in order to avoid getting ill? We're not there yet, and I do think that shift has to happen. I'm not certain who leads that, but I agree with the doctor that.
So Marie, I think we're losing you away from your mic, and I want to hear that last bit you said. Can you come closer to your mic and say that last little bit again, please?
No, I think what I was emphasizing is that we have not shifted from disease prevention to health, healthcare, or health maintenance, and we need to make that shift because we have to learn to live with COVID-19, just like we've had to learn to live with the flu.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
In order to do that, we need the skill sets or the education necessary tools to be able to live moving forward. So we need to make that shift. I don't know who leads that effort, but it needs to get underway.
So, Jennifer, I'm going to come back to you, and then I'm probably going to give a caller the last word here on this. Back to you, Jennifer Braceres.
Well, I agree with what Marie was saying in terms of learning to live with COVID the way we live with the flu. I mean, if we reach the point where, you know, it's still spreading and people are getting it, but people aren't ending up in the hospital as much and not dying in record numbers, and, you know, that people who are vaccinated are basically protected, then I think we need to completely go back to normal.
All right, I'm going to pick up one last call here. Dave from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. My problem was when the father called saying he wants to keep his mask on his daughter because she's not getting colds. That attitude is really horrible. We need to get the mask off the kids now, not 80%. That's not going to happen in a lot of communities for a long time. It's bad enough we closed schools for a year and a half, which turned out to be a big mistake, and we're paying for that now. And now we're punishing the kids by making them wear masks all the time. So I think we need to get them off right away.
I appreciate that call, Dave. So now what we've got here is the full gamut, right? From they've got to come off now to they've got to stay on to there is a threshold. The state's threshold is 80%. I think that's the conversation we're going to continue to watch now in the days and weeks ahead. I do want to now leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs, which are those little stories that caught our attention this week. I've got a big one, and I'm going to save that for a little bit later. But Marie and Jennifer, I want to turn to you now for yours. Marie St. Fleur, do you have a hubbub for us today?
I actually don't have a hubbub today.
All right. So I have an idea for you, which I'll come back to in just a minute. And Jennifer Braceras, how about you?
Well, this isn't a small story. I guess it's a big story. But we turn the clocks back tomorrow night, Saturday night, as we do every year. And I know Massachusetts has sort of repeatedly looked into whether or not we could abolish this practice and just stay on daylight savings time. It's something I think that's long overdue. In fact, you know, if you look at a map, you see that New England is pushed out over sort of the rest of the East Coast and makes much more sense to have it in the same time zone as Puerto Rico and just stay there. But I don't think it'll ever happen because people here will never agree to be on a different time zone as New York, but it should. It would be better for everybody's mental health.
So that is cracking me up because actually that would have been the thing I would have suggested to Marie St. Fleur as well, especially as somebody who, by the way, was raised in the Midwest where this time of year, sun is just rising at 8 a.m. So Marie, would you be in favor of doing away with the daylight savings time?
I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, I remember a time when we didn't have it. So
how do we make that work legislatively, Marie? Is it even doable, or is Jennifer right? Great, we all would love to do it, or many would, but it's just never going to happen.
I think you need it. You would need congressional authority. So you can states can they're allowed to not go on daylight savings time, but what Massachusetts has I think talked about in the past, and what I would propose is staying on it. So Congress has not authorized states to say, we're going to always be on daylight saving time. They've only authorized the converse.
All right. So, listeners, that is your subject for the weekend. Talk amongst yourselves. Should we stay on daylight savings time? All right. Listen, before my hubbub, I'm going to say goodbye to our guest, Jennifer Braceras, political analyst, lawyer, and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks. And Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Always great to have you, Marie. Thanks
so
much.
Good to be with you, Tatiana. And great job on the debates.
Hey, thanks, Marie. I appreciate it. All right. So I wanted to do my hubbub this week on the passing of Jerry Remy last Saturday. A week shy of his 69th birthday, he died of cancer. Beloved voice in Boston. But I'm going to turn my hubbub over to Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick.
Jerry Remy had been living with lung cancer for a long time, and he actually talked about it pretty openly and honestly.
I took a CAT scan, and my normal CAT scan that I take every 3 months, and a spot showed up. We took a PET scan. That lit up, so it was cancerous. And in the meantime, we've been deciding, the doctors have been deciding, you know, how to treat it.
So to paraphrase former Red Sox pitcher and Remy's nesting colleague, Dennis Eckersley, it wasn't surprising to hear the news this week, but you're still never prepared to lose someone so iconic. Remy grew up in Somerset, Massachusetts, and was always a diehard Red Sox fan. And after playing in the major leagues with the Angels for 3 years, he was actually lucky enough to be traded to the team he grew up rooting for. Remy was the kind of player that Boston fans can't get enough of. Scrappy, maybe not the most physically talented, but someone you knew was going to give you every single thing he had every single night. But it was obviously his second career as the Red Sox TV color commentator for NESN that endeared him so deeply to Red Sox Nation. Remy took over in the booth in 1988, and the rest of us were never the same. Every Red Sox fan knows exactly what I mean when I say, here comes the pizza.
Now watch. I can't circle. I don't have my telestrator today, but here comes the pizza. See it? Oh, jeez.
Highly unnecessary.
Guy with the Patriots jacket, and of course he's been asked to leave the ball game for ruining a good piece of pizza. So beer all over him. And here goes
some pizza.
He was the first one to laugh at himself, say, hypothetically, when he fell off a table while dancing and playing air guitar and then trying to put on a professional face to do baseball analysis.
One more, can you say? I can't say anymore.
All right, Jerry.
Sorry.
We got to ask you what happened, because apparently we have the video, Jerry. We're going to see the video here. This is Jerry Remy up in the booth a few minutes ago, just moments ago. People often wonder how the Rem Dog tunes up for a big game. And as you can see, Jerry very much... Jerry, I don't think there's anything else I can ask you after that.
No, I think that's about it.
He made it feel like we were all hanging out together, watching the game at the local sports bar. And there were a lot of laughs.
This is a first.
This is a first.
This is a first.
Yeah.
You've lost a lot of stuff during games, but you've never,
I never lost a tooth.
A tooth.
No, I just completely lost a tooth.
Which tooth? Is it something up front, I hope?
No.
I don't know. No, it's on the side.
You can't see it?
No. Can't see it at all.
Yeah. There it is.
There were so many moments when we got to laugh along with Remy. The giant beach ball, giving Orsillo a lesson on taking selfies, the giant paper airplane, or the crash course on how windshield wipers work, just to name a few. Listening to a great sports announcer, and specifically one who shares a connection to the city and the team they broadcast for, is one of the truly special experiences you get to have as a sports fan. Jerry Remy was in all of our living rooms for more than three decades. He wanted nothing more than to be a part of the city of Boston's legacy, and he was certainly that. Jerry Remy was, like all of us, a flawed human being. But ultimately, he was also one of us, a diehard fan of the Red Sox and a diehard fan of Boston.
The best choice I ever made in my life was to take the TV job. It has been a terrific job for me. And I thank you for welcoming me into your homes for the last 30 years.
Thank you to Radio Boston's Chris Siderick for that special hubbub remembering our beloved Jerry Remy. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston's produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you spent the week with us this week. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. And join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.